Hello and welcome to the ABN AMRO second quarter 2023 analyst and investor call. My name is Laura, and I will be your coordinator for today's event. Please note this call is being recorded, and for the duration of the call, your lines will be on listen only. However, you will have the opportunity to ask questions at the end of the call. This can be done by pressing star one on your telephone keypad to register your question. If you require assistance at any point, please press star zero and you will be connected to an operator. I will now hand you over to your host, Robert Swaak, the CEO, to begin today's conference. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to our Q2 results. I'm joined by Ferdinand Vaandrager, our interim CFO, and as always, by Tanja Cuppen, our CRO. I'll update you on the main topics for this quarter before we start the Q&A session. Let me first take you through the highlights on slide two. Very pleased with another quarter of strong results. Net profit reflects strong NII and is supported by impairment releases as credit quality remains solid. NII continued to benefit from the higher interest rate environment. Our overall deposit volume remains stable, while clients continue to transfer cash into interest-bearing accounts. Business momentum is also holding up for corporate lending. We again managed to show growth on our mortgage portfolio despite a slow housing market. We have lowered our FY 2023 cost outlook to 5.2 billion, as the SRF contribution this year was lower than expected. The tight labor market is causing a delay in sourcing qualified staff we need for a number of investments, and therefore will lead to a cost overrun into 2024. In addition, the continued higher inflation and slower reduction of our AML cost than we had anticipated also means that we will not be successful in bringing down cost to 4.7% by 2024. Now, as we're nearing the end of our plan period, we will also be updating you on our financial targets at our Q4 results. In addition, we will present a new capital framework and update you on potential share buybacks. To round off the highlights, we've set our interim dividend at 62 cents for the first half of 2023. Turning to slide three, let me say a few words on our progress on executing our strategy. Now, we are continuing to invest in our digital capabilities, including artificial intelligence, which has the potential to improve many aspects of our operations. In Q2, we launched an interesting pilot that used an on-prem ChatGPT server, which automatically records and summarizes client calls. In addition, during the call, the advisor is automatically prompted with the right product pages based on the conversation. The advisors involved in the pilot are very enthusiastic as it allows them to spend more time with their clients, and we are currently evaluating how we can incorporate this further and more broadly in our operations. We are progressing further on the simplification of our wealth management organization, and this quarter we established the branchification of Nefisa. Our impact fund went live, and what is unique for this type of fund is the low minimum threshold of 50,000 euros. This offers more clients the opportunity to continue to invest in companies striving for positive impact on people, planet, and society. ABN AMRO Ventures invested in a company whose product we use to detect fraud and protect our clients against malware, for example. On the Dutch economy, which you'll find on slide four. The Dutch industry PMI rose slightly in July, but still indicates a contraction of activity. And the outlook for the German industry worsened, however, which is an important export market for the Netherlands. On the positive side, many sectors still carry large order books, and we are starting to see lower purchase prices coming through. Bankruptcy remains low, confirming the resilience of the Dutch economy. House prices have now fallen 6% on average due to higher mortgage rates and deteriorated housing market sentiment. The end of the price correction is in sight, and for 2024, we now expect a modest 3% decline. The affordability and financing of homes will gradually improve as wage increases come through to compensate for inflation. And also, the low number of transactions reflects the lack of new construction, which is hampered by higher interest rates, price inflation for materials, and environmental restrictions. The second quarter performance, let's take first NII, and you'll find that on slide five. Looking back at the last four quarters, our NII showed a strong recovery from the negative rate environment, mainly as deposit margins improved. Deposit margins still increased a bit further during Q2, but the effect of the higher rates is starting to level off. The margin we locked in on new mortgage production was in line with our average portfolio margin, and also the portfolio volume increased somewhat. Corporate margins are holding up. And for deposits, the competitive forces we experience and the impact this has on volumes and margins will become the main driver going forward. We expect to start to see some margin pressure on saving accounts following the last increase of 25 bips as of August 1st. Treasury result was $50 million lower this quarter, and that was caused by unfavorable interest rates resets. This is not structural, and we expect a recovery followed by a further increase as the Treasury result still stands to benefit from higher rates. Looking ahead to the next quarter, I expect a recovery in Treasury results while we may start to see some margin pressure on savings. So turning to slide 6 on balance sheet developments. We are achieving good results in our strategic focus sectors, which are the digital sector, mobility, and new energy. We made further gains in all of these sectors, particularly in our Northwest European markets. In our home market, the mortgage portfolio held up despite the slow housing market, and new mortgage applications are gradually increasing, though, so the third quarter might end up a bit stronger. Consumer loans declined due to higher repayments and less demand. This quarter, we further reduced the remaining non-core portfolio, which is now down to just $500 million. We are making good progress on winding down the non-core back office operations in the various countries. Moving to our client deposit base, as expected, clients continue to optimize their cash by switching to interest-bearing accounts. Overall, our client deposit volumes remain stable, and we see limited deposits leaving the bank as most of our clients opt for the savings products we have on offer, in particular our time deposits. Returning to fees and other income on slide 7. Fees were flat compared to last quarter. During the second quarter, the market volatility was lower compared to previous quarter, and this is reflected in clearance fee income. Debt and equity markets were quiet in Q2, and fees were lower as a result. Nevertheless, corporate banking showed an increase in fees and fee income due to a one-off fee booked in non-core. Wealth management fee income was also stable, driven by stable results for asset management. And other income was up versus Q1, largely related to fair value adjustments from IFRS 17 and higher treasury results. Now turning to slide 8 on costs. Our cost-saving programs continue to deliver cost reductions. We made further progress on winding down non-core operations, and the implementation of our new client service model is also leading to savings. We booked a release related to the Single Resolution Fund as the contribution was lower than we originally anticipated, and this will bring down regulatory leverage for the full year to around $340 million. And as a consequence, we now expect full-year costs of around $5.2 billion. At the beginning of the year, we flagged a need to further invest in our data capabilities, our digitalization of our processes, and building up of our sustainable finance regulation capabilities. We are, due to tight labor markets, experiencing delays in sourcing staff for these projects. So we expect investment costs to increase in the second half of the year and to run over into 2024. Now, this is in contrast to the assumptions we made on our cost target, where we, in fact, anticipated investments to decrease by $100 million in 2024. Also, more effort than expected is required to ensure our AML activities can be maintained at the high standards needed to fulfill our gatekeeper role. And it is clear that our AML processes are becoming increasingly more complex, and our original assumptions on related cost reductions need to be reviewed. We acknowledged at the beginning of the year that it would be challenging to reach our 2024 cost target. An increasing number of our original assumptions back in 2020 have come under pressure, and we face an inflationary environment, continued delayed investments, or I should say delayed investments, and new insight in our future AML operations. We will deliver on our non-core cost reduction, and I also expect regulatory levies to come down further. But as we stand here today, it is clear we're not going to succeed in reaching our target of $4.7 billion by next year, but I will add immediately that we will remain fully committed to cost effectiveness. That is not changing. We've started to work on a financial plan for the years ahead, and therefore we'll present you with our new financial targets with our Q4 results. Turning to impairments on slide 9. This quarter, we saw a release in impairments of $69 million, which was for a large part related to the release of the remaining COVID overlay and a net release on individual corporate files. After an assessment of a large number of clients, we concluded that the impact of COVID-19 on our clients has been absorbed in the credit risk metrics, and an overlay was no longer warranted. The overlay related to the war in Ukraine is obviously kept in place. There was some new provisioning related to inflow in Stage 3, however, more than offset by releases in individual corporate files, both in core and non-core. The inflow in Stage 3 for mortgages was related to the introduction of stricter credit monitoring metrics. The credit quality of our book remains solid, and the impact of the economic slowdown in our loan portfolio is not visible so far. And therefore, we expect the cost of risk for 2023 to remain well below our through-the-cycle cost of risk of 20 basis points. Slide 10 on capital. Our Basel III capital ratio stands at 4.9% and Basel IV at around 16%, and we remain well capitalized. 50% of our net profit is added to Common Equity Tier 1 capital, and the other half accrued to our dividend reserves. Offsetting the capital generations were higher RWAs due to modeled updates, and this is only partially offset by credit quality improvements and business developments. The countercyclical buffer increase as of May 25th has raised the MDA trigger to 10.5%. However, our capital position remains well beyond this level. Now, to round out with our financial targets, we're off to a good start of the year, with an ROE well above our 10% ambition. Our NII has recovered from the negative interest rate environment, and we have more or less completed the de-risking of our balance sheet with the wind down of our non-core portfolio. A solid risk profile and a resilient Dutch economy have led to impairment releases over the first half of the year, which has further boosted our results. As I mentioned, cost target for 24 no longer achievable, also given the delay we are currently facing in attracting staff. We have announced that we will present our new financial targets and capital framework with our Q4 results, given that we're nearing the end of our plan period. In addition, we will present or update you on our share buybacks. I guess this is the time to ask the operator to open the call for questions.
Thank you. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Thank you. We'll now take our first question from Giulia Miotto at Morgan Stanley. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, good morning. A couple of questions for me. The first one, maybe not necessarily related to the results, is rather on bank taxes. We have seen some headlines yesterday coming from Italy. Totally.
Sorry, say again, Giulia, on bank taxes.
Oh, can you hear me well? Okay, perfect.
I was saying
we have seen some totally unexpected headlines yesterday coming from Italy, and I was wondering if you sense anything similar coming in any of your markets. So that is my first question. Then the second question on the NII line. So ABN has a long-dated replicating portfolio, and therefore I was wondering how... Whereas, you know, rates are expected to start coming down towards the end of next year and then in 2025. So how long do you think the NII can keep growing for? And if you could maybe update the rate sensitivity guidance, that would be also very welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Julia. I'll ask Ferdinand to take the questions on NII. Yeah, on the unexpected communication out of Italy, I'll leave it for the Italians to deal with the outcome of that. We translated it into our main market. We haven't had any kind of suggestion of announcements of the kind. I would also say that the Dutch market right now, in the way of interest rates and deposit rates, is a very transparent market. We have optionality for our customers in market. Customers can switch between banks fairly easily, and there is a wide variety of interest rates, if I can say that, on offer. In addition, what we also have had in particularly the Dutch market, the Dutch banks have been paying bank taxes for about 10 years now. It's about 500 million on an annual basis for ABN AMRO, about 100 million. So we've already had some kind of a measure for banks to be taxed separately. We see a good functioning market on interest rates here in the Netherlands, with customers actually having a choice. And also, I would say, you know, windfall gains. I mean, if you look at the way the development of ROEs generally in the past versus where we are now, and we're quite happy where we're ending up now. But to start to talk about windfall gains in light of financial the financial results over the last few years, I think that's certainly trying to come to terms with that term, let me put it that way. So in summary, a functioning market, a transparent market, customer choice, and bank taxes that are being paid. So we haven't really heard any of the these kinds of messages coming into our market. NII, Fredino?
Yeah, hi, Julia. If you look for this quarter to the underlying drivers, number one is deposit margins, where we still see improvements, although it's clear that the effect of higher rates on the replicating portfolio starts gradually leveling off from current levels. Then secondly, you have the treasury results, our equity mismatch. Yeah, that will keep adding over the coming quarters as a positive driver, but already indicated this can be volatile. So to provide a bit more transparency, we said it was a quarter-on-quarter negative from a roughly 50 million related to the repricing profile of our swap portfolio. But if you look for the next quarter, that's why we say it was due to volatility, we can already see the roll-off from some shorter-term receiver swaps that will catch up in the next quarter. Then the last lever clearly what's happening with asset margins on lending products, and there we see that they're holding up as pricing is catching up with higher rates. So then going forward, yeah, we are entering now more of a BAU situations where deposit margins will be driven by the effect of competition on volumes and markets. You've seen we have a stable deposit level, but you've also seen in the past 4 months there were 3 rate increases. So the ability to predict what's going to happen there is low, and competition behavior is unknown. But what you do see that the margins on current accounts clearly still benefit from higher rates, and also our treasury results continue to benefit from that. So also your link to the replicating portfolio, and then I stop there. Clearly, around 40% is on less than heavy prices in less than a year. And overall, it's roughly 3-year duration, but you know the investments there in swaps is in a barbell structure.
Thank you. Can I just follow up on one thing you said? So replicating portfolio is leveling off. So does this mean that you don't expect the benefit to continue to come through for a few quarters, or is that still a positive? I would have thought the replicating portfolio is still a positive to your NII.
Yes, but I'm just saying the rate of increases quarter over quarter is leveling off.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
And then that's still a positive.
Yeah.
Thank you. And we'll now move on to our next question from Flora Beckerhead at Jefferies. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. The first
morning.
Question I wanted to ask you is coming back to the NII. I mean, I just heard, you know, all the details that you gave us, and thank you for this. The question I have is very simple. Based on everything you just described, it looks to me, also thinking that we are about to have rate cuts, probably next year, should we expect, therefore, that this year is going to be the peak of NII? And when we look forward toward 24, 25, there is a risk that NII declines. The second question is on RWA. I think you had guided on the past that the model review impact would last all year. We had it in Q2. We had it in Q1. Should we expect further RWA increase from model reviews in H2 this year as well? Thank you.
Ready NII, and then Tony.
Yeah, NII, and I know it's a key topic. Is it peak NII or not? I just explained what the underlying elements and drivers are, and as you already alluded to, the expectation of potentially the ECB pivoting, is that happening end of year or next year? So with all those elements and also an unknown volume margin on the back of competition, it's very hard to predict that. And I think it's definitely too early to start guiding what we expect NII to do in 24 and 25.
Okay. Yes. Hi. On RWA. Yeah. As you indicated, we have taken significant steps already in simplifying our model landscape and preparing for the introduction of Basel IV, and thereby had the largest part of RWA increases is behind us. We do expect further RWA increases that can result from, for example, model reviews that we are doing on an ongoing basis, but also methodology and policy changes, and still also moving IRB models to more standardized or foundation approaches. So, yes, we will continue to work on our model landscape and adjust RWAs as it comes. I think important to know as well is that the impact of model-related increases under Basel IV are lower than under Basel III.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now move on to our next question from Farquhar Murray at Autonomous. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Morning all. Just two questions, if I may. Firstly, on the capital return update, could you just elaborate on the reasoning for timing this to year-end results? It feels a little bit like a deferral. And is ABN now committing to a strict annual pattern of updates from here, which seems perhaps a bit less frequent than peers? And then secondly, just coming back to the NII conversation, thanks for the details there. Just in terms of that 50 million step down, should I therefore think of that as kind of a permanent kind of clunk down in terms of the treasury book that probably gradually recovers? Or are you suggesting that receiver swap conversation is actually going to recover a fair chunk of that relatively quickly? I just wouldn't mind understanding how to look through the volatility there, if that's okay. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the questions. Ferdinand will follow up on NII. Just let me take capital return. You know, since we are updating our financial KPIs at the end of the year, because we're nearing the end of a plan period, we also thought it was good to then update our capital framework at the same time, because clearly we're running into the end of we're getting nearer to the end of a plan period based on assumptions that we had concluded off on in 2020. And we felt it was better then to take both the update on our targets together with an update on capital framework, and therefore then also can be able to conclude off on potential share buyback. So we'd rather do it together than start to do this piecemeal. And I think from where we are in the plan period, it makes good sense. In terms of the frequency that you've alluded to, I wouldn't infer any conclusions from the fact that we're doing an update on our financial targets in Q1. We will review our capital framework and we'll come back and revert then at that time, both on the framework and on share buybacks.
Yeah, Farquhar. Hi, just coming back on the more volatility in the treasury result. As said, it's clearly still a positive, but the positive effect is lower than in the previous quarter. We've always said that this line item can be volatile because it's fully related to the repricing profile of the swap portfolio. So can this quickly revert in the next quarter? As I said already in the previous comments, we are highlighting this and also expect this to recover if you look at the next quarter. As I said, that's potentially linked to the roll-off of some shorter-term receiver swaps, which can then have the additional positive effect in the next one.
Okay, great. Many thanks.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Tariq El-Majed at Bank of America. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Just two actually follow-up questions on still on NII. I mean, I understand and it's very helpful the different moving parts you gave us, but I'm still really like a bit surprised by the fact that you can't give us a net guidance on the trend of NII, because if you think the main driver here is the competition from from deposit rates. Maybe you can give us a sensitivity on where deposit beta would go, or terminal one, by the end of the year, and then we can have at least a range of NII target there or guidance. So that's the first one. So would you be able to give us then that range function of deposit beta? And secondly, on the capital return, I hear your question about you want to do everything together with Q4 results, but I guess this is about the threshold of 15% and so on. But returning capital progressively, at least some share buyback in second half could have been done independently from that, I guess, no? So were you rather planning to use some of the capital to do some acquisitions in wealth management that didn't happen, and then you had to delay distribution, or was it always the plan to not do anything this year and then wait for next year? Thank you.
Yeah, I'll take the your last question, and Freddie, I think we'll expand a little bit more on NII, although we have to say that there's a high level of uncertainty, but I won't get ahead of that answer. When we talked about share buybacks and the timing of announcing any further share buybacks, we did not commit to any timing of those share buybacks. And there is a preference to, once you begin to update and to begin to review the financial performance of the bank, particularly going forward into a next plan period, and at the same time, want to be very clear on share buybacks and your capital framework, that you do need to take that together. We do think that given where we are right now, we have a good view as to what we expect to, how we expect to land in 23, what the potential is for landing in 24, including insights further in some of the other choices that we've been making, as it relates and has effect on our capital framework, that it's good to do that all together. I'll just remind you that when we came up with our capital framework, this is back in 2020, with a number of variables that, as we talked about in previous calls, have either changed or have been adjusted. So we'd like to have that overview. Absolutely appreciate that there is a need for more information on share buybacks. We still remain committed to the to capital return. But indeed, we'd like to present that together so you have a one view in one time. Rather than starting to do this in chunks, which I don't think we've ever done, and we'd much rather have that complete overview.
Yes, Hein, then maybe following on pass-through expectations and what guidance get. Well, it's pretty clear we can observe what the beta or the pass-through has been so far, and it's relatively low. It's around the 20%. But as I said before, over the past 4 months, we've seen 4 rate increases. We definitely do not price based on a beta, and that's where I had the earlier comments, because it's really dependent on the competitive behavior, as well as the yield on the replicating portfolio. If you look at our deposits, do we see a shift or migration from current accounts? 97 billion, most of that we pay 0% on. Yes, you start to see some optimizing there. So in Q1, you saw a migration of roughly 10 billion into time deposits or saving accounts. That slowed down now to around 6 billion. So even there, despite the gap between the saving rates and the current accounts increasing, we don't see a significant migration. But as said, also for ABN, where by far the majority of the deposits comes from the Netherlands, we don't provide any sort of forward-looking expectation on a beta, because that would sort of implicitly sort of guide what our pricing expectation is. But for now, it's the beta is around 20%. We don't see any outflow. You see some transfer into interest-bearing deposits. And our loan-to-deposit is almost at historic low level. So there's no incentive for us to be a price leader in terms of rate increases on savings. Let's leave it.
Thank you. So the 20% deposit beta is after the August rate hikes?
Yeah, so that's okay. If you include all, so that's also including then your current accounts where you pay zero in. So if you just look at the saving accounts, then clearly the beta is 30 to 35%. So it depends on what your definition of a deposit beta is.
Okay, thank you.
Is that clear? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll now move on to our next question from Marta Sanchez Romero at Citi. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my questions.
Morning.
The first one, could you please remind us your priorities in terms of capital allocation? Do you think you need to make the bank more efficient and hence you would prioritize cost restructuring or even M&A before increasing capital repatriation to shareholders? My second question is related to the first one, really. Do you think your commitment to reduce costs will imply additional restructuring charges? And the third one is a quick follow-up on Flora's question on risk-weighted asset inflation. Ballpark, what fully loaded credit tier one headwind should we expect from the review of internal models? Thank you.
Can you repeat your last question? Because you're coming through a...
Do I need to repeat it?
Yeah, just very quickly.
Ballpark, what is the impact on fully loaded Core Equity Tier 1 expected from the ongoing review of internal models? Thank you.
Yeah, I'll take your first question. I'll ask Ferdinand to take the second, and Sonia will take the third. On prioritizing capital allocation, I think we've always been very clear that the way we execute our strategy, we've made a very clear choice in the segments we serve and the Northwest European geographies that we serve. So that's an organic execution of our strategy with an associated capital allocation, if you will, in terms of executing our strategy. M&A has been a part of a strategy that we would always consider. As we've talked about M&A in the past, it hasn't changed today. If there's an opportunity that would help us execute our strategy more effectively and therefore be accretive, but also financially accretive, then certainly M&A is something that we take under consideration, and that would then lead to the necessary capital allocations. So the way we're executing our strategy means that we stay committed to the choices we've made around the segments, the growth segments, the geographical areas, and that will carry with it an associated capital allocation. And when M&A opportunity comes up, we will then take the consequences, review, and clearly allocate as necessary.
Yeah, maybe follow on cost. First of all, the outlook for this year. So we guide now to around 5.2. So the major reason for lowering that was the announced Single Resolution Fund contribution, which was around 70 million lower. But it's also, we said, we have an underrun in certain investments we're doing. And Robert said already by the introduction, it's investment in digitalization of our processes, but also, for example, significant investments in data capabilities and data infrastructure. What we need is we need to report more and more on non-financial data, also linked to sustainable finance regulation. Secondly, in the second half, also the second phase of our increased CLA of 2.5% kicks in. So that's why we guide for 5.2. And if you annualize the current run rate, you will be below that. And then if you go for the outlook for costs for 24, in the previous quarters, we always link this to five levers. Two of them are still very much relevant. First of all, is the cost in non-core. It's over last year, it was roughly 160 million. So we still expect definitely 100 million of cost to come out of there. And secondly, it's a lowering of the regulatory levies of up to 200 million. And I think with the lower SRF contribution, you've seen the first part of that. On the other levers, and that's also the reason why we don't see any, despite really focusing on cost, we think the 4.7 is not achievable. And number one is much higher inflation than expected in 2020. So the 100 million lower costs coming from cost savings being higher than inflation, that is less achievable now. Then the number two is the investments. As I said, we have an underrun in some of the investments, so that will flow through into 2024. Also there, that was earlier guided for roughly 100 million. And lastly, you have the AML sort of expected cost coming down when we end up in a BAU situation. Well, Robert alluded to that. Also there, the up to 100 million reduction might be postponed beyond 2024. So that's why you get some sense of the direction of travel towards 2024. Then your last question, how do you link that to a potential restructuring cost? I know we mentioned the restructuring cost in 2020. We have not booked any significant restructuring costs. But as I'm saying, we have an underrun currently in some of the priorities we're doing. We're reskilling staff, and you also see that specifically from external staff, the headcount has come down quite significantly in a year's time. So the conclusion of that is that I do not expect any significant restructuring professional cost in 2024.
Okay.
Sorry, a bit of a long answer, but I hope it provides you with some context. Now we're not fully subscribing to the 4.7.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and then maybe on your third question on RWA, well, once we do model reviews and have visibility on the impacts, we do include it in our calculations and in our financials. So all the visibility that we do have, we have included, and once we finalize new model reviews, there might be implications, but that's not something we can predict what the size will be in the future.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, kind of. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. We'll now move on to our next question from Benoit Petrarch at Kepler Cheuvreux. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my questions. So the first one is on NII. Maybe just to take a bit of long-term perspective on the deposit margin. Could you help us to understand where your deposit margin is currently versus the long-term average? I think ING is actually discussing a lot on NII split deposit margin versus lending margin. And again, that's very useful. And I think it would be nice to have the same type of disclosure for ABN. But just wondering where you are now currently on the deposit margin. On the capital framework, what do you have in mind currently? You know, you had this 15% in the past. Is that still something you want to keep, where you happy with that, or you've seen some maybe limits to setting kind of a threshold? So just kind of try to get a bit of direction into what we could get in February. And sorry, it's not clear to me yet fully what is holding you back to announce a share buyback in H2. I guess it's maybe a bit of an M&A angle to that, but again, just wanted to have that clear, because I think on your profitability level and KPIs, I think, you know, I'm not sure if it's something you really need to give an update on share buyback. And then maybe just finally on the fees, you had a 23 million one-off positive. Is that a real positive, or do we need to strip that out, i.e. to get it to a clean level of fees, or in Q2, or you think Q2 was especially low because of, you know, low volatility, weak financial market, and so on? Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Benoit, the deposit margin fees, fading out, we'll take. On what we expect to announce in terms of the capital framework at Q1, Let me just say that all components of our current capital framework will be under review to ensure that what we come up with, again, is something that we can carry for a period. So we will be reviewing all the components. That's probably as far as I can say at this point, because we're as you can imagine, we're still in the midst of working our way into that, into what the capital framework actually would look like. But all components will be on the review. And I appreciate the question on timing of share buybacks and your second year, or sorry, the suggestion on the second half of the year. Again, I just revert to what I would say earlier. If we are in a situation where we have good reason to review our plans, I mean, we want to continue to instill the cost discipline. We want to ensure that as we are in an inflationary environment, which is changing, we come to the right conclusions in terms of our cost levels, but also at various income levels over a plan period that will have ultimately will be drawn into the share buybacks that we want to do. And it is very clear, and I just confirm that also in this call, that we will stay committed to regular share buybacks as we did also over the course of the last periods. So that will continue to feature, but as I said, we'd like to have the overall view and then communicate what the outcome of that is and do that all in one go.
Yes, Benoit, first of all, on your fees, why are we highlighting 23 million? It's basically because we still have our disclosures on non-core, and this fee came from non-core. And as you know, our overall loans are now down to roughly 500 million. So there's a very small tail remaining there, and we're in the process of transferring the residual from the countries to the Netherlands. So as it is in non-core, it's something we highlight. So if you look quarter on quarter, this is something you as an analyst could strip out. Then on margin development, we had the discussion before. I know the disclosures you just mentioned from another bank, but do realize for us the deposits are fully related to almost fully related to the Dutch market, and that's also one of the reasons why we're not explicitly stating what our margins or forecasts are there. What I did say is that we still see an increasing deposit margin this quarter. I also said if you look overall to the asset margin side, it is roughly flat for corporates. If you look for consumer loans, it's a relatively small portfolio where you do have clearly some pressure on margins because your funding costs go up and you have statutory interest of maximum 12%. And on mortgages, we do start in a phase now, although lower productions, where a new inflow of margins clearly are at a higher level than what we saw last year. So the new production is now more or less at the level of what the back book margin is. So that should give you some color on the underlying levers of the alpha margin development. But the most important reason is, as I just said, our fully dependency on the Netherlands, that we don't want to provide an explicit overview of deposit margin.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you find that your questions have been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2. Thank you. We'll now move on to our next question from Gillon at BNP Paribas Exane. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking the time. Two questions on capital. The first one is on the table where you show the Tier 1 ratio, etc. The regulatory and other adjustments has increased from a negative 120 to a negative 330. So I was wondering what that was. And the other element is still on the RWA and the change in the models, because you're losing all of your retained earnings to an increase in RWA. B, as far as I know, not many banks are experiencing such an impact from changes in models. So I was wondering whether you can elaborate a little bit more as to what's wrong with your models. Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Tanja.
Yes, I'm looking for the header table that you are referring to.
It's page
31.
It's page 31. in the report.
Thank you.
Is it okay? It's a rather detailed question that we start with the second part of your question first.
Sure.
And
sure.
Also maybe because we don't have the Q report here readily available for us, that the investor relations will pick up with you after this call. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. And maybe you can repeat the second question?
The second question still is with regard to the change in the models, because not many banks are seeing such an impact from changes in model on RWA. And so I was wondering what is wrong with your model, because you've changed them already quite a lot since 4 years.
Yeah, that's true. And we are actively working on simplifying our model landscape. Also ahead of Basel IV. A significant part of our models is related to what is called the low default portfolios. And because of the fact that there are low defaults, it's a bit counterintuitive. It's not always easy to develop models that meet the requirements that that are set today. So if the number of defaults are too low, it's not possible to develop an advanced model. And that's why we are reviewing our model landscape and also moving portfolios to less advanced approaches. And we do that also ahead of Basel IV, because under Basel IV you get input floors that put in a floor and in any case, for other parts of the portfolio, even required to go to an LGD that is prescribed by regulation. That's the case for the large corporates. So that explains our moves. Of course, I cannot see what choices other banks are making in terms of transitioning from where they are today to the Basel IV environment.
Okay, thank you.
We'll come back on your first question on the REC and other adjustments in the queue.
Yeah, thank you. Because it's a half of your retained earnings, so it's quite an impact, quite a non-negligible impact.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Benjamin Goy at Deutsche Bank. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, good morning. Two questions, please. One on asset quality, one on your deposits. First, maybe you can speak a bit more about your stage three inflows, any trends you're seeing with typically isolated cases. And the second question is on the deposits, because you have been, let's say, a fast follower on the deposit side, but sometimes following with a lag. I was just wondering whether 25 basis points really makes a difference to your clients to switch banks, or is there some inelasticity in the deposit base? Because so far deposits are stable and we only see the mix shift within ABN AMRO. I was just wondering how it affects competition. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, Tony, if you want to take the stage three, I'll take the deposits.
Yeah. So on stage three, and you see that also in our disclosure set, the stage three exposure for corporates came down a little bit, and that's the net impact of outflows and inflows. So we did see some inflow, I would say nothing extraordinary, and also no specific trend there in terms of sectors. So you see kind of, the inflow getting to, I would say, more normal levels and leading to some additions in provisions, but as said, offset by the fact that we were successful in resolving files, at the non-core side, but also in the core portfolio, we were able to generate outflow in stage three.
And on your question on deposits and the reaction of customers, it is actually obvious now in for the second quarter. We've had a number of rate hikes. We see some migration. So we've seen for this quarter about a 7 billion migration away from current accounts into savings accounts and time deposits. And it actually, what it tells you is that whereas the overall deposit space then remains stable, is that our clients are clearly opting for the interest rates that we've offered them in conjunction very, very often with some of the other banking relationships that they have with us. So I think it's good to see that there is a that clients continue to make use of an interest rate that we've offered whilst they're continuing the relationship with our bank as well. The market in the Netherlands, I guess, to earlier comments, is competitive in that sense that there's different interest rates being offered, but at this point the migration away from ABN AMRO is indeed very limited, and I would subscribe to the reason here that it's also due to the relationship that these clients have with our bank, among many of the other products that they will have with ABN AMRO, and not just only their current accounts or saving accounts.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Raul Sinha at JP Morgan. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my questions. Can I have two, please? Maybe one on detail and one broader question. The one on detail is just coming back to your comment on the replicating portfolio tailwind leveling off. I'm sorry to come back to that, but obviously it's numbers that we cannot see from the outside. And I just wanted to explore a little bit of why that might be the case, for the bank. And just assuming that this is probably because the short-term element of your replicating barbell has completely repriced. And I guess you probably still have some tailwind from the long-term, long-duration element of it. So if you confirm that. And then the second related point to this replicating question is, can I check if this is also because the equity replication is booked in other income rather than NII? Is that one of the reasons why perhaps some of the repricing of the replication is not in NII, and that's probably why you're making the comment of leveling off? That's the first question. I don't know if you want to answer that first, and then we can take the second one.
Okay, go ahead, Daniel.
No, it's fine. As I said, on the replicating, so the leveling off, to put it in context, we're definitely not saying that we don't think there are further increases ahead, but the rate of increases underlying will gradually slow down, as you rightfully say. 40 to 45% of the replicating portfolio reprices within a year. So we've seen already quite a bit of that that benefit, and the overall duration is roughly 3 years. So there will still be a tailwind, although the quarter on quarter increases will gradually start to level off. And on equity replicating, I don't know if you refer to the overall equity mismatch.
I'm just talking about the equity base.
The equity base. Yeah, but that's also in NII, and that's a book there under treasury income.
Got it. Thank you. I guess the second one.
So the treasury result in other income is more related to overall hedge ineffectiveness, what's in there. But overall, the equity income is also booked under NII. So that's included.
Got it. Thank you. That's very clear. The second one, maybe for Robert, is just on fee income growth, which is running, well below, it's flat, it's running well below your sort of medium-term aspirations of 5 to 7%. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on the evolution from here and whether you're coming to the conclusion that M&A might be really needed to supplement your franchise in order to really kickstart kind of longer term fee growth from here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the question. Yeah, fee income has been flat for this quarter, but I think it's good to realize that fee income for some part of the fee income, about half of it is also very attributable to market performance. So both wealth management and clearing have had the effects of relatively quiet markets come through in terms of the fee generating capability that we saw. We came off of a very strong clearing performance in Q1, and we've had over the last periods, we've had fee growth of around 7%. So I would still say, you know, based on the fee generating capabilities that we have, also in terms of the segments that we've identified in our strategy, which would generate fees, we're still very much investing in those areas. We still think that those are areas that will continue to generate sufficient fees for us. But in part, we're depending on market circumstances. So overall, we would look to maintain the 4 to 7% CAGR that we set out for 20 to 24. And in terms of your question on M&A, and look, you know what I said before, if we think that M&A is relevant to any of these components of our strategy, but it is also very clear that we would consider M&A. And components of our strategy would be feeder lines within the bank. It would be around wealth management, as we've indicated before. So, yeah, I mean, if those opportunities present themselves, we'll review them. But we still stick very much with the organic growth capability in the segment choices that we've made as it relates to fees.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Amit Goel at Barclays. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. So two questions for me. The first on capital. I think you mentioned that all aspects of the capital framework are under review, and a lot has changed since it was originally set. Just wanted to check, you know, from your perspective, what are the key changes that have happened? And in general, are you thinking about more or less capital return? And then secondly, on costs, I'm pretty sure we'll get an update with Q4, but also I just wanted to check your expectations for 24-25. Do you think you can do better than the 5.1 billion of costs that's in consensus for 2024? And if the 4.7 billion isn't achievable by then, do you know, should we think about it as achievable for 2025 or not? Thank you.
Yeah, so on capital, I mean, clearly we're in different economic circumstances than we were back in 2020. So we took up some considerations in those 200 basis points on the economic situation. We did not have the inflationary environment in which we're currently operating. At the same time, we've taken out some uncertainties that we had at the time, predominantly relating to settlements that we needed to conclude off with the Dutch public prosecutor. So there were a number of those components that began to constitute the build up to a threshold have either changed or been adjusted. So that is why we definitely want to review all the aspects of our capital framework. In terms of cost, you know, I would suffice to say at this point, the cost discipline will continue to be there. Clearly, we have to, as Ferdinand has indicated, the various components that we currently have under review. I don't think you should defer anything from that in terms of the where we're going to end up ultimately, other than the fact that we will continue to execute a high level of cost discipline as we come up with that new number for 24. I think, in all fairness, it's a bit too soon to begin to indicate what that number potentially could be. But the cost discipline will remain. That's not changing. And I think some of the factors that have led us to release the 4.7 right now, in a way, are just unavoidable given the situation we are in terms of inflationary pressure in light of the pressure on the labor markets. And at the same time, you will have seen us realize some of these cost savings and continue to execute on some of the cost savings. For example, as Ferdinand has already indicated, non-core will still continue to execute against those programs and some other existing programs that we have in place. But too soon at this point to give you a final number, but we will do so at Q4.
Got it. But just also to understand from what you're saying, so the 24 also then starts to provide a new run rate going forwards into 25 and beyond, given the pressures that are driving it.
Yeah, let us complete the analysis, and then we can give you that complete view in Q1.
Thank you.
Sorry, Q4. Apologies.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Kiri at HSBC. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. A couple of questions from my side. Firstly, just a very quick one. In terms of the persistence of those AML remediation costs into 2024, can we just have some reassurance that no fresh issues have actually popped up on the radar screen that you might need to address here, that it really is just a timing issue in terms of winding down the resources you've got deployed there on AML remediation? And then secondly, just on wealth management and picking up on some of your comments about organic growth, have you got specific plans to make opportunistic hires of private bankers in Western Europe, say, you know, basically accelerate the growth and hiring plans in wealth management, you know, just because there's this big integration project involving two of the biggest players in private banking globally going on at the moment? Or is it more a case that, you know, current cost pressures on issues of your cost targets for next year means you maybe have to take your foot off the pedal there in terms of chasing organic growth and maybe, you know, take a back seat given some of those concerns there? Thank you.
Yeah, I'll take both your questions. So let me just be clear that we expect to complete our work on remediation programs on our AML client files. We still expect to complete those in 23. So that will continue. But indeed, as we said, as we're nearing the completion of the client file remediation, we are also wanting to ensure that we continue to maintain the levels required, so to make the AML, the ongoing AML activities much more continued sustainable and keep them at an adequate level for the various regulatory requirements. So we will complete the client file remediation programs in 23, and then beyond 23, we will continue to ensure that we have our ongoing AML activities at par. And therefore, we do think that that will need either more cost or it will drive cost to an extent that we do not see yet our AML reduction as we had envisioned initially to come in the period within which we had indicated. So the AML benefits will come in more gradually. We will continue to invest to ensure that our BAU AML activities are of the quality that is required. And then on your question, in terms of are we open for team grabs or are we continuing to invest? You know, we've done so over the last plan period. So we will continue to invest and explicitly to a point of team grabs where we can, we will. We've done that in certain areas. Our current indications on cost and cost levels are not preventing us from executing the strategies we set out for our wealth management practice. So we are very much committed to the markets we're currently in, so in Germany, in France, and in Belgium. And we continue to invest where necessary, and that does include hiring corporate bankers or hiring wealth management bankers to come into our practice. So we will continue to do that. That stands aside from the discussion we have on costs.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Anke at RBC. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Thank you for taking my question at this stage. Just two small ones. Firstly, really on the buyback, apologies for coming back. But would you already apply for approval before disclosing your plan, or would it be you present your plan in February and then ask for approval, which then obviously would mean you only start later? And then secondly, with respect to your costs, and your continued focus on cost discipline. Do I understand this correctly? The focus on absolute costs, you think is the right thing, or is it in the current environment better to focus on a cost income ratio? Thank you.
Yeah, so on the on buybacks, we're always in a what I would call constructive dialogue with our regulators. Both in terms of the planning that we're doing, what we're communicating to you today, so that communication will be ongoing. We have yet to decide, based on the analysis that we do, exactly what we're looking at in terms of the capital framework and any potential share buybacks, but we will carry that into the conversation, obviously, with our regulator, as we, by the way, always do. And just remind me again your second question.
Are you going to focus on absolute cost, or do you think a cost-income ratio is a better way to look at it?
So we will continue to focus on absolute cost because that does provide very, very clear focus also within the bank, and we've seen some very good results over the last 2 years. Our focus on an absolute cost, of course, in terms of the comparables and comparisons we do to assess our overall performance, we use cost to income as a ratio to do benchmarks. But the guiding will continue to be on absolute cost.
Okay, thank you. If you can just clarify on the first question, the point that an ongoing dialogue would imply you could also already talk about the buyback when you present your plan, and you don't have to wait to ask for approval after you present your full plan.
We always will carry a incomplete dialogue with the regulator, and that's also about the intentions we have on any potential share buybacks.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now take a follow-up question from Flora at Jefferies. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Just two quick clarifications, please. The one is regarding the MDA, where, on the slide 10, you have a footnote that mentions the MDA went up, but it is expected to go up again next year. So I just wanted to check I have the right numbers there. My understanding is it is now going to be at 10.5% for this year, and you expect it will go to 11.1% next year. And then the second question is on the Single Resolution Fund. You had talked before about a discussion with the SRB on the calculation method. Can you maybe remind us how much is at stake here and the timing that you expect for the resolution of this conflict with the regulatory authority on this? Thank you.
Antonio, if you take the MBA and then fading off a bit more color.
Yeah, I can also take the MDA. It's fine. Okay. If you look at the MDA trigger based on SREP now, as communicated, it's at 10.5. So that already increased because the counter-cyclical buffer first effect of 1% is included in there. And clearly, if you look from Q2 next year, this will increase again because the counter-cyclical buffer there for the Netherlands will move from plus 1 to plus 2%. So that will be the increase as of Q2 2024. The second question is on the dispute with the single resolution board. I think overall, we disclosed before what the overall costs are, that is, or what they're claiming. That's 120 million pre-tax over the period 2016 to 2022. And that's really related to what the calculation methods they are using, specifically related to our mortgage bank. So since the start in 2016. So we did pay the 120 million under protest just to comply with the Dutch regulation, but we booked it as other assets. So it has no P&L impact, and we will keep challenging this SRB decision also in court, but clearly the outcome is always uncertain.
Okay, so to be clear on this, there is a risk that if you lose this dispute, you have to take 120 million through your P&L, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We'll now take our last question from Jason at ING. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, good morning. The first question is on wealth management. I'm coming back to the point that was made before on fees and commission, where you say that, there is a, due to volatility and markets, the progression has been a bit slower. But if I go back to about, it's all 10 quarters, I mean, it has been remarkably stable. So it was 145 in second quarter 21, it's 146 this quarter. So there doesn't seem to be a benefit in wealth management from markets and also from inflows. So could you comment on that? That would be great. And also if you could provide us with a split of discretionary versus non-discretionary in your wealth management. The second question is on missing out on the Crooke Petercam acquisition. Could you comment on why you dropped out of the race? And putting the price aside, just a generic question, is do you find that the company may not be ready to pursue more aggressively such deals, or do you find that's not an issue? Finally, on the share buybacks, I mean, the consensus was expecting this 250 million. Nearly everyone had seen the numbers. And over the last 4 years, we seem to be quite often having a disconnect between the quantum and the timing on this issue. So with what you will announce in February, do I understand it that, you know, over the period of 3 years or whatever, there is going to be total clarity on threshold, timing, quantum, including a, in a certain way, M&A plans, so that, you know, we don't need to go through this start and stop that we have seen over the last 4 years? And if you could include there in your comments if there is any relation with the Dutch state stake reduction, and if it has any bearings on the share buyback, just thinking about the contingent last year, so that we get an overall picture of what to expect for February. Thank you very much.
Yeah, to start off with the last part of your question, there is no relation there. The state continuing to execute their programs in a potential share buyback. The second part of your question, we will review, as I said, we'll review all the components that we need for a capital framework to ensure that we have, again, just a complete communication on how we look at the various components of the capital framework and the associated share buyback. So we'll be as complete as we can be at Q4. And in terms of your wealth management question, it's more about the different parts of wealth management that may be more susceptible to market performance. I also mentioned clearing. So it does very much depend on inflow, clearly also of our NNA, which we've, again, also this year or this quarter, we've seen a positive inflow in terms of cash. But yeah, it is very much a components within wealth management that are are affected by market performance. It's not a one-to-one relationship in of itself, but it is very clear that if market performance trends up, then on management asset management, we'll see the fees starting to increase as well. But so are sensitive to market movements. The I don't have the splits for discretionary.
No, we don't disclose the discretionary portfolio management from the FI, so we don't disclose that.
Okay. Thank you very much. And on the Crooke Petercam acquisition, or if at least you can comment on the, you know, how
there's a reason to be. Yeah, I don't comment on individual transactions that are reported in markets. I would suffice to say that what I said earlier in the call, and I've said in previous calls, will continue to hold true, that we're ready for the type of M&A that we feel we need to do in light of the business models that we currently have. And I would leave it at that.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. There are no further questions in queue. I will now hand it back to Robert for closing remarks. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and thanks everyone for joining again today, and look forward to the follow-up conversations. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. Continue to stay safe. You may now disconnect.